This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
That, what did she say? I'm not sure, it was muffled. Maybe it was just a moan. No, I'm certain it was something urgent. Dirge, merge. Maybe she was mumbling that it hurt. Perhaps, but we know that it hurts, so I doubt she would feel urged to murmur that. Could it have been purge? That does follow her fundamental suggestibility. Do you think it is our influence shaping the materialization? Yes, maybe. Do you think it could have been a merge? E is 24 years of age, medium height, and small build. She is small, healthy, and soft. Smear, sense. Rushes, dry skin, and eczema. Hands and feet are measured. Regular. Mute. Little. Even is going to strike particularly your eyes.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And we have surprise guests today. Paul Robertson from Lust and the Apple Gallery. Good afternoon, Paul.
Hello, William. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And could you introduce your companion today?
Well, this is Megan Bain, who's been very shy and probably hasn't ever been on radio ever before, so perhaps...
Megan, what's her second name?
Bain.
Bain.
You may get a noise out of her or not. You do your best.
And you said she's going to sing for us today?
Yes, at 3 o'clock.
Okay.
She's going to sing a song she promised.
Yeah. All right.
A chanteuse of the highest quality.
Okay. So, Megan, what do you do? What is your...
Megan works around with me actually quite a lot. She's
okay.
Been remarkably shy.
Yeah.
But Lust and the Apple is an art gallery, a very small private one that I run in the middle of nowhere.
Okay. So where is nowhere?
Nowhere is Temple in Midlothian outside of Edinburgh.
Right.
It's a former Knights Templar Ballywick. And apparently when the Knights Templar were thrown out of Paris, I think it was 1310, they loaded 3 ships of gold and they brought them to Scotland. Now, they had 3 bailiwicks in Scotland, one of which was Temple, and they buried the gold between an elm and an oak tree.
Right.
And I have both in my garden.
Okay.
So I have the Temple gold.
You keep
gold.
Digging?
No, yeah. I'm not going to dig it. It's far better to have the story. You know, people come every year with metal detectors, actually.
Do they?
Round about.
Yeah. So does anyone make it to the gallery? It sounds a difficult trek.
Remarkably difficult to get to the gallery. There is no public transport.
Oh.
If you want to come, you're more than welcome to come to the local train station 4 miles away.
Which is where?
That's in Gorebridge, a rather rough town.
Uh-huh.
The only place where, and we can get to this later on, where someone's offered to murder someone for me for £300.
Right. Anyone in particular or just?
Just someone that they heard a story about that I didn't like. Someone who ran off with my former partner.
Okay.
That. Yeah. And I didn't take them up on the offer, may I needlessly say.
Okay.
No need to send the plod around to see me. And,
So this is near Edinburgh, right?
This is near Edinburgh. And it is so awful that, and I hope this is not too awful a story to tell, when they realised I wasn't going to pay for him to be killed, they offered to have him stuck with an HIV needle for £120. That is how rough that place is.
Okay.
And then we have my sophistication of an art gallery.
This is the place you call home.
It's not far from where I call home.
Why did you choose this place, of all places in the world?
Well, it's a very prosaic reason, right? I mean, I'm an art dealer and I have a collection.
Yeah, but it doesn't sound like a potentially useful place for an art gallery.
I love being here. I love London.
It sounds like you're in hiding to me.
Well, then maybe that would be true. I love London and I love all the things that go on, right? Yeah. And perhaps for me, being in the middle of nowhere where I only have fields all around me is not the best place for someone of my disposition. But I pay £650 a month for a 2,500 square foot primary school. I have a 1,000-metre-square garden that's walled and a car park for 10 cars. Eat your heart out, anyone who's
I know, but it's an art gallery. Of course it's cheap.
Well, yes, it's not that cheap. But, I mean, you know, this is the difference between living in the middle of nowhere in Scotland and here. Yeah. You know, you're in Scotland, you can go and buy a church for £10,000.
Right.
I mean, does that not appeal to you, going living in a church?
No, but I'm not running an art gallery. I mean, presumably, if you run an art gallery, you want people to come and see the thing, don't you?
Oh, I mean, we have events and people do come, right? I mean, it's by appointment. So you phone me up and I'll come and pick you up off the train station, actually. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, right.
That's okay. Look, these are good artists that we're showing.
Okay. I mean, so the gallery's called Lust and the Apple.
Yes, it is.
Who have you shown?
Currently, it's Christian Boltanski.
Oh, right. Okay.
Christian is one of my heroes. I've been collecting his work for years.
Right.
And I hope people listening might know his work. I mean, he's foremost French artist really living.
We've heard of Boltanski.
You have. Yeah. He's reached down here. Absolutely. These parochial parts of the world.
He's filtered down from Gorebridge.
When we live up there, we turn the map upside down, right?
Yeah, okay.
Although I have to say this now, I'm English living in Scotland, right? Yeah. So it's a bit... I have very, very... I'm almost split personality on Scottish identity because I'm very anti-nationalism but very pro-Scotland.
Right.
But anyway, we can come back.
But you're from Birmingham.
Originally, yes.
Yeah.
But anyway, to go back to Boltanski, I'm glad you've heard of him, right? He's one of my heroes, and I happened to go and meet him in Paris a year or so ago.
Yeah.
And he turned out to be one of the most lovely people I've ever met.
Hmm.
Really generous.
Right.
And... it'd be just showing off to say he turned around and gave me a work off his wall for free.
Mm-hmm.
But we're working together, hopefully next year, in Norwich Cathedral.
Okay.
It's not completely confirmed, so if you're hearing from this in Norwich, please don't quote. But it's an exhibition installation in Norwich Cathedral of a new work. Quite a spiritual work, I think, which is why the cathedral's an appropriate place.
So are you instrumental in that? Are you somehow curating it or something?
Yes, I'll be the curator for that show.
Right.
And... I'm really looking forward to that. I mean, I think that it's 100 bulbs on cables, and they will be stretched out in one part of the cathedral, a very public part, attached to a computer. And every day the computer will randomly select one bulb and send a pulse to it, and the bulb will burst. So after 100 days, daily, one by one, the bulbs will disappear and go out and be pitch black.
Right.
Now, it's a very easy work to read that, isn't it? I mean, it's about death and randomness and, you know, span of life.
Who goes next sort of thing?
It could be me.
It could be. You haven't been too well, have you?
No, but I have to hang on till that, right? You know, I think, you know, I think we should put names on the bulbs.
Right? You were at the inn at the beginning of the Summer Hall gallery?
Yeah, I ran that for a while, the visual arts there. I put on 180 exhibitions in 3 years.
Right. This is in Edinburgh for people that don't know. Yeah.
It's a big private space. It's difficult because at the end of it, it didn't end well for me. I went a year without being paid any wages. And I mean, I shouldn't really reveal too much about all of that.
Uh-huh.
But I loved the place. It was really a fun thing to do. I was lucky to work with really great artists, Susan Hiller. We had Fail there, the street artists, Lawrence Wiener, Carolee Schneeman. I mean, there's a list of maybe 30 or 40 international artists I managed to bring there.
Right.
And we never had any money, so I got them to come for nothing, which is a bit unfair, but they're rich enough, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think Lawrence Wiener needs another £50,000. You know?
No.
And sometimes when you approach them, they're pro-art, really pro-art. So, you know, they're more interested in the show than getting the money when they've got to that point, you know?
Right. Right. And the so how do you get into art, Paul?
Oh, well, I was in politics and there was a bit of a scandal. I think we talked about this the last time I was here.
Well, that
here,
was right? quite a while ago. You can refresh our memories. It's probably quite a good time to discuss politics, maybe. Especially as I'm going to play a record later, mm-hmm. which is by somebody you might have heard of called Benedict Drew.
Mm.
He had a big show. Well, he had a show at the Whitechapel recently,
oh, really? No,
which is where you're going.
Yes.
And the name of the record is, what is it? Crawling Through Tory Slime.
Well, that works for me.
Is the name of the record.
Although I find myself in political limbo these days. But
do you?
I'm a socialist, a democratic socialist all my days, and with a long history of working with the Labour Party.
Right.
But I'm no Corbynista.
You're not?
No, I'm not. And
come on, run that past me again. You support the Labour Party, but you're not a Corbynista.
23 years ago, I think it was 2 days ago.
What do you mean? 23
years ago, 2 days ago, Neil Kinnock stood up and threw the militant tendency out of the Labour Party. And now, after 23 years, that faction or people who supported them are back and are in charge of it. And I don't support that.
Oh, you think Corbyn and McDonnell are part of the militant tendency?
No, they're not. They certainly supported them at the time in the sense that the militant were an interest group, right? It was a political party within a party.
Yeah, yeah.
Gosh, we jump around on subjects here.
Are they anything like Momentum?
No, Momentum is... I'll give Momentum its due. It's infused people. It's brought new people in. My problem is with economic policies rather than the enthusiasm. There's nothing wrong with a bit of revolutionary zeal.
Right.
And I still am a socialist. I regard that. I'm just worried that if we were in power, the economic policies would possibly damage this nation quite badly. But there is nowhere to go. I mean, I have a problem. The Liberal Democrats are just disasters.
Okay.
I mean, certainly no Tory. And I mean, I was thinking earlier how May is really helpless and hapless. That would have been a better slogan for her for the general election rather than the one that she went with. the events of this week, just watching the disaster that unfolded over 25 minutes at that conference was astonishing.
But you don't like the look of the alternative?
Only it's about economic policies. I'm very much in favour of their social policies.
Okay.
The Labour Party's position on equality movements of any kind is pretty much... I have a little bit of a worry that anti-Semitism is raising its voice in the Labour Party.
I've never noticed it myself.
Well,
I'm a member of the Labour Party, but I'm not aware of it.
Being pro-Palestinian is not being anti-Semitic. I would regard myself as a supporter of a Palestine nation,
right.
But sometimes it crosses the line. I think people sometimes forget. It's very, very nuanced at times,
okay.
I think.
All right. We won't go there.
But we've jumped all the way to politics. And
well, they're not necessarily distinct from each other, are they?
No, I'm very interested in the nexus, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, philosophy-wise, I would say I'm an international situationist, a proto-situationist.
Right.
That's the political line.
Yeah.
I believe that Marxism is a wonderful way of understanding the past, dialectical materialism. I think it has nil value predicting the future.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't think anything can predict the future.
Mm.
So, tell me, I match those two things up.
The problem you had with the Labour Party?
There's
this lobbying. You were a lobbyist, weren't you?
No, I was a consultant behind the scenes. The best way to describe me was a propagandist. I used to write the leaflets and produce them, design them and everything else for major elections.
Right.
And so I'm trying to remember, I think it was 98.
Right.
I would have done almost every Scottish MP's propaganda, for want of a better way of doing it, and a fair chunk of...
The Scottish Labour Party?
Yes.
Right.
And also I did work for London people and some of the North East,
uh-huh.
and then quite a number of the European seats as well.
Right.
And I did that as a personal private company. But prior to that, I'd run a company that was owned by the Labour Party.
Right.
That actually was a problem because, I remember we wanted to expand the company, a printing company for the Labour Party. And I went to the bank and the bank just said, so whose house do we repossess? And there's no answer for that if you're a cooperative or, you know, an organisation.
Right. They wanted security.
They wanted security. So it ended up I had to do it myself in my own name. Did that for maybe 10, 15 years. And then there was a massive scandal in Scotland around the first Muslim MP in Britain called Mohamed Sawa. And there was an expenses investigation. MPs were only allowed to spend so much money in an election, and the Labour Party was accused of overspending. And as I was the largest person in terms of turnover invoiced in the Labour Party, I was investigated by the police. And of course the Scottish National Party jumped on this, and there was a lot of debate in the press, and I refused to say anything. I mean, I just, out of loyalty to the Labour Party.
That's unusual for you.
Yes, well, I can't talk for Britain. No, but I refused to say anything. And the way the Labour Party thanked me for that was stopping using me as a consultant. It's a standard political trick that once you are tainted by any sort of scandal, that you just get isolated and left aside.
Right.
So I had to do something else, and being an art dealer looked easy.
You must have had some background in art to become an art dealer.
I made the biggest mistakes on earth, right? One of the very first things I ever bought was a Warhol fake, right?
Okay.
I mean, now I look back at that with huge embarrassment. It was a supposed shoe. Warhol in his early days would sit around his table with his mother and Truman Capote would come in, for example. And he would have drawn shoes or other drawings. And he used a great deal of ink, and then he blotted the ink onto another piece of paper. And that reverse image is what he used. They would print up lithographs. And then they would sit around the table and hand-colour them all. And then his mother would sign them. And they would be Andy Warholer, which was his original name. And so there are the Cat series, and then there's all these pictures of pretty boys.
Was it Andrew Warholer or Andy?
Andy Warholer. I think it was Andy Warholer. Okay. You've seen them. So his mother signed all of those in ink. And it's a very, very... In the way that later on when you see Warhol, his line is nigh perfect. It's with ease he draws a curlicue or, you know, a line around. Or often the later works are portraits where he overdraws on the face. It's so easy for him. You could see in a second.
So they saw you coming.
They saw me coming. But no, and I bought this. I bought this thing on eBay that was a foot, one of the shoes, and it was coloured in. And I didn't even know about things like cattle rasne in those days when I first started. You know, you get cattle rasne, for anyone doesn't know, is the books that catalogue all the works by one artist. And so you can check whether they're correct or, you know, are they numbered or are they signed? Where's the signature on the
page? How much did you pay for it?
Oh, not much. I think it was a few hundred dollars.
With a view to selling it again?
Yes.
Okay. So then what happened? You tried to sell it?
No, I didn't. I realised actually not so long afterwards. The real embarrassing thing is that I actually found it in a book. And what they'd done is they'd photocopied they'd photocopied the outline, created it into a litho, and then hand-coloured it in.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean... let's call it a rookie mistake. Right? I've got a bit better than then. But I mean, I also, I bought a number of Santa Polonia prints by Warhol. Santa Polonia is the patron saint of dentists because she was martyred by having all of her teeth pulled out. And there is a, is it Botticelli? Painting of her holding a tooth up in a pair of pliers. And Warhol did a number of these Renaissance paintings where he reprinted the original. Being a colourist, he changed the colours. And with these over drawings that he had. And there were four different ones of Santa Polonia in different colours. And they're not the most popular Warhol things.
Okay. But you must have learned fast because you're a relatively successful dealer now.
Well, I was just
gallery is quite obscure, but you do deal... You buy and sell to clients without necessarily it touching a gallery. Is that right?
Yes, although I'd never buy anything I don't like myself because you can get left.
You never
it.
What, sorry?
I never buy anything I don't like myself.
Okay.
But, I mean, just to finish that, Santa Polonia, I got those And I put an advert in a dental magazine and sold them within a week
right.
to a dentist in Manchester who put them up. And I thought, this is the easiest job on the planet. Ah, okay. You know, I've just turned this remarkable profit over just buying a Warhol and selling it.
Right.
And then it was 2 years till I sold the next thing.
Right.
Okay. And, you needed deep pockets to get through 2 years.
Yeah. But you became you're a book dealer as well, or not? Did you just call yourself a dealer?
Yeah, I think it's a touch on everything from counterculture, which can be anything from a Sinn Féin leaflet in the 1920s,
right.
All the way through all of the art that is actually political. I mean, Paris 1968, all of these wonderful posters that were made for the walls of the Sorbonne
right.
and the Situationist work. Mm. But then actually into fine art and the artists that I work mostly.
Does it trouble you at all ethically to be a democratic socialist and also to be a dealer?
Yes, I've made my peace with that, though.
How do you do that?
By supporting pretty young artists in Scotland. I mean, I always... I mean, every time I put on a Christian Boltanski, I'm also showing someone first ever exhibition.
Hmm.
And I'm usually buying a work off them.
Okay.
So I know, I completely understand anyone who thinks what a piece of hypocrisy this is to be dealing in very high value items.
Yeah,
I mean, there's Pokemon cards for rich people. Uh-huh. At the level that I work with, there are one or two clear collectors who I know who would buy every single thing by Kippenberger they could get their hands on, for example.
Yeah.
And I find a Martin Kippenberger, I offer it to them, and I find it. I tour the world to find these things.
Right.
Then I go and send off them to people.
Okay.
And so
you appease your guilt by supporting young artists.
Yes.
And that's fine with you then. That's the end of it.
I can't think of any other solution to it other than, going into penury and becoming a monk.
Aren't you just earning a living? Because the best way you know how, what else would you do?
I could be an anchoress or an anchor. Have you heard of this?
No.
I found out about this quite recently. It's really fascinating. It was usually women, and they would be close to a church, and they would declare themselves an anchoress. And an add-on to the church, a bit much like a brick lean-to, would be built in the church, and they would be bricked into it. A small hole would be left for two holes, really. One for the buckets of eau de to be taken outside, and another hole which allowed some people to talk to this woman and food and water to be passed in.
Right.
But they'd live the rest of their lives.
Okay.
This
is what you would do instead of being a dealer?
Yeah. Don't you want to do that? The sacrifice.
I think that's a bit of a... I think that's what's known as a cop-out. You're kind of moving the goalposts. Megan, what do you think?
I think he'd be a terrible anchoress.
A terrible anchoress?
Yeah.
Why was it only an anchoress and not an anchor?
I think it was sexist, actually. You know what? You self-chose. You weren't forced into this, right?
No, I should think. Right.
And it's a bit like, a vow of silence or going to become a... Yeah. I don't know what...
But do they... So they
Benedictine
lived,
monks?
They lived in the dark then, in this cubicle.
Yes. And they would... But they would regard it as paragons of virtue. So
that's the only way you can be a paragon of virtue is by is by being bricked up in a cubicle.
Yeah, that might work.
If you exist in the real world, are you saying you can't? You get compromised.
It's
one way
fascinating.
Or the other. Yeah,
there has to be a novel in this, right? But people would come to your window and ask for your advice because you're the paragon of virtue for the parish.
Yeah.
And there's some way...
All you could say is come and be bricked up too. I mean, follow their advice for anything else, surely.
I remember there's a novel. Now, who's it by? And it's based on all of the churches in London, the architect who made the churches in London.
Oh, yeah, the Hawksmoor. Aykroyd, is it?
Is it not
is
in
it
that?
Peter Aykroyd Ian Sinclair?
You're exactly right.
Okay.
And does it not reference the fact they threw virgins into the foundations? Dead ones, not live ones.
Now who's digressing wildly?
No, but I think it's a similar sort of idea, isn't it? This perfection.
What,
this
to sacrifice women?
No, I think that it died of their own accord, but, But should we get on to Aztec sacrifices? We can go there next if you want.
All right. Well, speaking of sacrifices, you're down for the Frieze Art Fair.
Yeah.
How's it going?
I think it's the best one for a while, but there is a problem with things like these art fairs.
Yeah.
And I go to a lot of them.
Right.
It's too much. It's too much art. And you know what? I'm going to sound like a complete hypocrite here, but just the money-making is just a bit disgusting at times. Right.
Okay.
I'd like to think I do it out of some intellectualism, right? I mean, that's really my motivation. I like being a cultural hoover. And I'm finding these things, and then they go off to Yale University or Michigan University or the British Library.
Yeah.
And so they're not lost. Okay. And people can lose these things if they don't know what they are. So someone with a knowledge base, there and then, because, of course, you can always know anything from Google, can find these things and in some ways save them. But I am making money for it. I'm not pretending otherwise.
So you're saying you make money out of freeze?
No, I make money out of finding these things by going to visit people.
Yeah.
Often other dealers, actually.
I mean,
you know, you find things. Dealers can be very lazy and they can have things in their hands that they just haven't a clue.
Right.
You know, I mean...
So it's a kind of something of an opportunist kind of... You're roving the fair with a view to perhaps...
No, you can't do that at Freeze. Freeze is just they're selling there to...
Yeah.
Very rich people or museums, or they're at least trying to pick up new clients.
Right.
And if you haven't been, it's a massive big tent, and there are, like any other trade fair, big white cubicles, and you pay to be there. And some of them will be paying hundreds of thousands of pounds for a cubicle.
Right.
Some very large galleries are there.
Yeah.
And then there's the smaller ones, and they're all just really trying to get their money back. I mean, you can't spend 20k on a cubicle and not sell like anything.
Yeah.
But you see too much, and a lot of it looks the same, and some of it looks like it should be in, you know, on display in a cafe for sale, which is the lowest of the low you can be in the art world, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm not wonderful. The best thing about Freeze is the sort of sideshows, all the other events. Basquiat is on at the Barbican.
Yeah.
It is amazingly good.
Okay.
It's a remarkably good survey of one of the most important artists of all time. Downstairs better than upstairs, but no, it's a good survey, and you won't see that many Basquiat's in one place ever again, I guess.
Right.
I mean, a small portrait, self-portrait by him. I was once offered one for $1 million, and that wasn't so many years ago.
Right.
And a lot of these works are a bit bigger. So if you want to be crass about it, the value of that exhibition is in many, many, many millions.
Sure.
But the story it tells is quite good. I think it's very good early on about the influences that he has, particularly the jazz and the black, or probably it was called coloured at the time. You know, social movements that there were, the rise of the black sportsman, right, becomes apparent in them.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, he's just very, very adroit with his brushwork.
Right.
It looks like a man who just doesn't have a care in the world. I think we're back to Warhol again.
The last time you were on this program, I think I sold you something on air.
Yes, you sold me the Ben Vautier.
Did I?
It was a flying saucer. And,
right. Yes.
It had been in a famous exhibition here in London, right?
Yeah.
And Vautier had slept in the window for the week of the exhibition.
Yeah.
And painted lots and lots of different things. Oh, you're trying to sell me something else. I can see this coming. You're a chatter.
I thought I'd show you some things on air, as it were.
Yeah, if you want.
And then you can make me an offer for them. So here's the first one.
But you know what I do. I only offer you half.
I know. It depends what the first price was.
Well, this is Raymond Pettibon, Tripping Corpse 5. Yeah. Now, Raymond Pettibon came out of the Seattle scene and was, I suppose, became grunge, perhaps pre-grunge in that sense.
Yeah.
And he is known for covers for Sonic Youth and other bands, and he did a lot of the flyers for, I've forgotten the name of it now. Do you remember the name of the record label?
No.
Okay. But he also produced these magazines, which are just reproduced drawings by him.
Yeah.
They're all a little bit off kilter because the image doesn't always relate to.
But isn't the story that he destroy some of them? Or
no, there were 500 of each of these made, and each one is numbered by hand by him, usually in red ink on the front cover.
Okay,
but only 100 of each of the batch survived.
Right.
Well, they say that. You know, of course, someone's trying to sell you that in a water disaster. So the basement with all of them in.
So that makes them pretty rare.
Rarer than. Lots of things.
A lot of them must have got thrown away. They're quite ephemeral things.
You know. Yeah. I mean, what am I looking at here? There's a woman undressing in a short skirt. It says, and the text is just Santa Monica High School, class of 68.
Right.
You know, there's no reason for that. And then it's a back of someone's head, all the hair cascading down, and the caption is, always worrying about losing all his hair. Right. Well, I mean, I know we all worry about that.
But he's a big name, Raymond Pettibon, isn't he?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, he's now very big. But when these came out, no one would buy them.
OK, so what's the value of this?
Well, you want 350 quid for it. I have had this particular one, Tripping Corpse 5, maybe four times in my life.
Uh-huh.
And it's not... I mean, do you really need me to explain it? Are the people really interested in this?
Well,
it's not uncommon, so paying you a lot of money for it doesn't work for me because I can't easily sell it.
How much would you offer me for it?
150.
150?
Yeah.
200?
No.
180?
No.
Okay.
You'll have it back. It's fine.
No, hang on to it for a minute. Have a look at this one.
All right. This is a buy, I take it.
Yeah.
It's a drawing over a commercial postcard by the Art Nucleare, an Italian artist, Bai.
Spelled B-A-J. Enrico Bai.
Bai, yeah.
Yeah.
Bai, in his later days, became famous for doing drawings of the general, which was this little childlike figure dressed up as a general, which was his take on Spanish fascism and authoritarianism in general. Very satirical.
Well, that's quite timely.
This is rather nice.
It is.
A monster and a bird-like image on top of a, is it coloured? Yeah, a colourised, but by the commercial printers, panorama of, I don't know where that is, does it say?
Well, it's addressed to Victor Musgrave.
Okay, Gallery One.
Who was the director of Gallery One.
He's quite famous.
Yeah.
Where is that? I can't read it. They've painted over the name of the town.
Yeah.
That's rather nice, actually.
Yes.
I wouldn't even know what to start offering you for that.
You wouldn't?
No.
I thought you were an art dealer.
I'll offer you 50 if you want.
No. Okay. The next one?
Oh, God. This is Gerhard Richter. This is just a test of my knowledge, isn't it?
That's no. I'm trying to sell you something.
This is a Gerhard Richter.
I want to make some money. I don't get paid for this, you know.
This is a Gerhard Richter postcard of...
Pass them over to Megan. She might know more about it.
She's scared of talking, that's what she is. This is called Olympia. It's from 1967.
Okay.
It's a painting by him at the period when he was part of the German pop art movement called Graphics of Capitalist Realism, to translate it.
Yeah, German pop art was all grey, wasn't it?
No, it was all... Well, yes, it was, because the other person is Sigmar Polka, who did with him.
Yeah.
And the two of them, their first exhibition, they took over a storefront and lived in the storefront for a week.
Oh, right.
Seems to be the Ben
Vogt. It seems to be the thing, doesn't it? That's how you attract attention. To sleep in the window. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Dali did it before that.
Right.
Not sleep, but he took over windows. Lynn Hirschman did something like that in America as well. Anyway, this is early Richters were painted often in grey, and they were images found in newspapers or in magazines that he painted in a more blurred fashion.
Yep.
So when you look at this, the detail isn't there, but it's actually nice. It's quite a sexy image. And this one's been signed and dated by him in 2001, quite recently.
Okay. Any offers?
Do you want to do the whole lot at the end? Do you want a job lot?
Well, you could start individually and then you could beat me down.
And I can even see what you're going to offer me next.
Can
you? Which is the Richard Hamilton hand-painted postcard.
And we both know where this came from.
Yeah, there's a guy, I'm not going to name him.
Don't name him, right? No.
There's a guy in London, if you're there, Peter, hi, who has stocks of these. These came from the Fraser Gallery.
Robert Fraser Gallery.
Robert Ray Fraser Gallery, who was a great friend of Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
And did he not go down with Mick Jagger?
Well, there's a famous image, isn't there, of Fraser and Jagger, and then there's like a metal handcuff on the front of
the image.
They've been photographed in the back of a police car, I think.
Because they got nicked for smoking marijuana or pot, as we used to call it.
And the title of it is something like...
It's called Release.
Right.
And it actually has lots of different versions.
Yeah.
And actually, it's a beautiful print and now very expensive.
Yeah.
And Hamilton, great friend of Duchamp, Marcel Duchamp, was a pop artist in British terms.
Yeah.
You know, so you have Blake and you have him and you have Alan Jones.
Yeah.
And this is an image from, is it Margate?
It's called Whitley Bay.
Oh, Whitley Bay, yes.
Or Whitley Bay. Whitley Bay, I think.
And it is just a load of bathers standing in the water.
Yeah.
But what he did was he hand-colorized it by silk screen so that, you know, the bathers are flesh-colored. No black people in this I see at all. The sand is yellow and pink and the... Yeah. Now, Peter, who you got this from...
Yes.
...phones me up every now and then and says, I've got my last... I've got my last Richard Hamilton postcard here.
Should we broadcast this? We're going to get into trouble with him for this. He's
going to get... He deserves it. You know, he lies to me every single time. This is my last one.
Okay.
I'm only looking for £200.
This might be libelous. Careful.
Okay, Peter, you don't really do that, right?
No.
I don't think... Can you be libelous if you don't name them? Oh, I have gone part of the way.
Okay, let's move... It's
anyway,
a postcard.
Right.
How much would you...
Let me just say this. I've had 20 postcards from him, each one the last one.
Okay.
Right. It's not libelous, but it's true, you know?
Yeah.
The last 10 I gave to Jonathan Monk, the Berlin artist.
Yeah.
Because Jonathan works with other people's postcards and then paints over them.
Okay.
And he's fascinated. He's a neoconceptualist, so he works from original conceptual art in the 60s to the present day.
Right.
So
how much would you offer for this?
Nothing. I've got four.
Oh, God.
Every one. I bought four, but every time I thought it was the last one.
Yeah,
I was told it was the last one. There's
okay.
More
so,
appear.
So far, you've offered me 150 for the Petit Bon.
They're worth about £400. Yeah. Although they have gone to people. This has gone to auction and gone for £1,600 before, which is just stupid.
Right.
But if you've got
but
two
you're
people,
offering me nothing. So this is
this is
typical of the art market, isn't it?
I just don't want
like,
it.
It's like you're selling one at £1,600 and then I offer you
I'm
one.
Not
it's like nothing.
You can buy one off me for £300. Okay. This is a very early Gilbert and George announcement card, right? From. I don't know, really. Probably 71, 70... Oh, 72. 1972 in autumn.
Yeah.
It's just the text. It takes a boy to understand a boy's point of view.
Yeah.
That's quite nice.
It's quite rare, that.
Yeah, I don't have this one.
No.
But I'm going to see a collection of Gilbert and George on Saturday morning.
Are
tomorrow
you?
Morning.
Oh, well.
From someone who was there, so maybe it's too early to offer me this.
Oh, there's always some ducky.
Well, these go for... You know, these sort of things can go anywhere between 40 and 75 quid, really, for Gilbert and George cards.
I think it's more than that. Okay. Now, here's this week's mystery object.
This is the one I'm not going to know. Okay, it's a book that has carpet on the boards, the outer cover, to make a oblong-like book. And it has inside it two very fragile pages made out of cloth on which have been stamped first the word and... And then the next one says the word thinking, right, on a sheet. And this I don't know. I can't recognise
even
this.
Megan's looking puzzled by this one. Perhaps
and
you...
It also has the letters O2 on it.
Yes.
Which, obviously, this is a promotional thing for the arena.
Actually, it never occurred to me. I never thought of that. I think it's an edition of two.
Who is it?
I think there are only two ever made of them. And it's like quite a long, complicated story, which I'll synopsise very quickly.
No, tell the long one.
It came from... Well, you know, you possibly remember the Nigel Greenwood Gallery, which went bankrupt.
Yes.
And all of the estate from the Nigel Greenwood Gallery went to auction. It ended up at Sotheby's, all of the books from his bookshop, which was on New Burlington Street, or Old Burlington Street, I can't remember now. It's one off Regent Street. And so all the stuff ended up in tea chests at this Sotheby's sale many years ago, and I bought one of the tea chests.
Just unopened.
Yeah, it was something like £180 for a tea chest full.
And you
of
didn't know
stuff.
What was inside?
No, I didn't really know what was inside.
Fun.
And it included a massive Richard Tuttle box with a gold bow in it.
Wow.
Which I had for years and couldn't sell it because I was asking too much. And then there were eight copies of Prince of Space by Eve Klein and Charles Wilp, a vinyl record with nothing on it at all. You played the record and it was completely silent on both sides.
And you have lucky bags when you were young? Because this is the art lucky bag.
Well, this is, I know.
You did really well out of that.
I know I did. I know I did, yeah.
How are you not sitting here in driving here in your Merc? We all going for lunch on you and hotel for hookers and coke.
Probably sold it too cheap. But one of the things was this carpet book, which happened to be, it had a label on it, and it was by Steve Lowe.
Okay.
And
doesn't really click with me, I'm sorry.
No, so I catalogued it, couldn't sell it. We had it in a shop window somewhere. It didn't sell for £50. Years later, 5 years went by, and then Steve Lowe opened the aquarium gallery.
Mm-hmm. I met him, I remember that.
That's right, yeah.
I bought a Banksy off him for next to nothing, and it went for, I feel bad now, 14 grand within 3 years.
Right.
But just went from nowhere to there.
It sort of clicked with me. I thought, Steve Lowe, I know that name. I know the name Steve Lowe. Why do I know this name? And I thought, that carpet book, I know, I'll offer it to him. I'll take it and show it to him. So I took and showed it to Steve Lowe. And, of course, he didn't want it back. It was something he'd done when, I think it was in his final year at college or something. Yeah. So he wasn't interested. He didn't want the thing back. So then eventually it got sold. I sold it with a whole box of poetry books to the poetry library in Hay on Wye.
Yes.
That's another, there's more to that story. But anyway, it went there. I'd forgotten this. I didn't remember that. And anyway, so another 5 years go by. And I mentioned this story to Dan Wilson, who's a sound artist. I said, I had this book called And Thinking, which is on industrial carpet. And he Googled it and found it advertised at the by Googling And Thinking and Carpet. He got to the poetry library, who were offering it for £30. He offered them £10 and they sold it to him.
Yes.
And he brought it back to me.
So this has so gone up fivefold in price.
It's now come back to me. I've got it again. So now I can offer it to you.
£2. Okay.
Do you want to talk about Michael Nyman? What about Michael Nyman?
Before that, do you still have the Tuttle?
No. That's long,
I just bought a Tuttle maquette
at
auction and I'm regretting it. Occasionally get briars almost.
Okay.
Just aluminium foil crunched up.
Right.
Sorry, yes.
You have a connection with Michael Nyman, I think.
I've just ended working with him for 3 years, doing exhibitions with him and working with him on his films.
Yeah,
Michael is a genius. There's no other word for it. Perhaps ignored a little bit in this country, but his film work isn't so well known.
Right.
I'm getting avant-garde sounds in my ears now, right? Is this a cue to shut up?
No, not at all. No.
But Michael remade Vertov's 1929 masterpiece.
Yeah.
We've shown that all around the world, and it's a complete frame-by-frame remaking of the piece using contemporary footage shown on anywhere between 6 and 13 monitors or transparent projections that you can walk through. And it's Man with a Movie Camera is the name of the original film.
Right.
This became Nyman with a Movie Camera.
Yeah.
The specially recorded soundtrack by Michael. And it is actually a wonderful, wonderful work. I also think Max Pugh, the editor, should get mentioned here. Max is at the London Film Festival at the moment.
Okay.
His mindfulness film is going the rounds that Google have funded, and I haven't seen it, but I'm told it's a wonderful documentary.
Right.
And Max edited the Nyman Movie Camera. But if people get a chance, I think it's going to be in Italy soon, is it? Do you remember? No.
So is that showing at the film festival, which is running at the moment?
I think
it's on this week.
I think perhaps not the Nyman, right?
No. But his other film.
Yeah.
No. Megan's shaking her head. Well, all counts.
Okay, I do know he's doing a panel this afternoon, right?
So. Megan.
That's right.
Yeah, is he doing a panel?
He is indeed doing a panel, but I don't think his film's showing. And I'm not completely sure, but I know it's in America.
Uh huh.
but I don't think they've got film rights in the UK.
Is it Walk With Me called? Is it
Something like that. Walk With Me, Walk With Us.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel bad that I can't remember the name. I haven't seen it. So it's just,
okay.
But I mean, you know, Google funding, you can't go much wrong, can you?
No, no.
So,
okay.
But that tells you. It's
I was playing. Tight, I'm know? Playing this because this might. I know you wouldn't. You wouldn't recognise this, but it's.
Yeah, I'm not knowledgeable on sound.
But the it might some part of it might ring a bell. The contemporary radical underground,
oh, right, so
which of course is your old friend Frederick Aquaviva.
Oh, Frederick, yes. He stopped talking to me for a while because I had sex with his wife.
Oh.
Sorry, this is a family show.
Well, that's all right.
Frederick's a wonderful man, right? He doesn't look. I've known Frederick
Megan,
for many years.
Megan has buried her face in a scarf.
Frederick has been a stalwart of letterism since I ever met him 20 years ago.
Yeah.
He has the most fantastic letterist collection. Now, letterism was a movement in Paris around Isidore Isou and Maurice Lamet.
Yeah.
Started in the 49 when Isou turned up in Paris having escaped, I think, Romania.
Yeah.
But he was not lacking in confidence, Isou. And at one point I had a book that he'd given to André Breton that basically said, I'm coming for you, I'm better, in the dedication copy.
Yeah,
it's actually a book called Our André Breton, André Breton being the surrealist leader.
Yeah.
And Isou for 40 years ploughed this furrow in which he scraped art back to the letter. He said that Dada had taken art back to the sound, the guttural sound.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had Schwitter's poems, which are just noise.
Mm.
But Isou went back to the letter.
Right.
So the basis of all of the paintings and all of the works were the letter. Mm. But also Isou had no qualms in writing about every subject under the earth, from psychotherapy to major scientific ideas to architecture, without any background knowledge at all. He just made the stuff up as he went along. But, you know, all artists are mad.
Yeah.
But that's a bit sweeping, but there's no more truth in it. And anyway, so Isou really, really kept going. And one can make a case for it being the one avant-garde movement that the world has forgotten about.
Mm.
But quite important, and certainly if you're French. And all of a sudden now, Frederick has been keeping that torch alive for many years, as well as being a remarkable composer himself. His work is really good. And he's with
Laura Luxemburg.
Laura Luxemburg.
Who's a soprano.
A soprano.
Yeah, yeah.
Wonderful woman.
Yeah, he invited me to show my film in Berlin.
Yeah, well, I mean, you probably should have gone.
I did go.
Oh, was it good?
Yeah. No.
The film or the event?
No, the film's good. He came to see the film at the film festival, and he liked it a lot. And he sort of said, "Oh yes, you must come to Berlin. I'll give you a screening in Berlin."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Yeah, okay." And you know, a year went by, and then finally we decided to go. And he said, "Yeah, okay, we'll do it." So we went on the Sandra and I went on the train to Berlin. I like Frederick. You know, he likes the film a lot. Mm-hmm. But I went with the expectation that on a bad day there might be 20 people. So he invited us to stay in his gallery, and we thought, no, we're going to stay in a hotel, which was just as well because the gallery is like an ex-surgery, and he lives in this surgery, which is still kitted out like a surgery with these sort of like gurneys, you know, like things that it still looks like a surgery. And he was exhibiting paintings by Orlan.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Collages and photographs.
That's perfect for that, because Orlan's work is all about plastic surgery.
Plastic surgery.
And some of the most disgusting art you could ever buy, little files of her fat and things.
That's right. And sort of having having dental work done to herself, you know, and sort of close-ups of clamps on her teeth and all this sort of thing.
But she now has horns. She has permanent horns. I mean, this is somebody who was doing body modification long before...
Right.
You know, it was more common. I mean, I don't think it's
so the previous show was Orlan in this medical place where he was living, and he invited us to stay there, and we said, no, we're going to stay in a hotel. So
no, we've got a gurney for each of you.
A week before, I was saying, "Have you done some publicity with the film?" You know, and he was saying, 800 people came to the Orlan," and I thought, "Yes, okay. Have you done any publicity for the film?" And this went on. So anyway, the long and the short of it is, it came to the night of the screening, and it was like 1 minute before eight, and two people had turned up, and they were both friends of mine, and. Then a woman on a bicycle turned up at 8:05. We don't know who she was, but she left before the end. And I think there was one other person. And I think that's right, two people came late. Anyway, as a screening, I mean, it was an unmitigated disaster.
Yes.
But we're still friends, it's fine.
Berlin's a nice place.
Yeah, I'd never been before.
At least I gave you a larger opening than that, even though you were lost.
I'm beginning to wonder if this is a sort of network, you know, you and Frederick.
Oh, come on,
there was like a sort of conspiracy.
1,000 people at your opening in Edinburgh when I put you on.
They weren't at my opening, they were all flooding in for the party.
Well, there was a party, there was free booze and drink.
The list.
What did you want?
Something called The List, which I hadn't understood at the Summer Hall. And it turns out to be a sort of magazine. So it's sort of as we were leaving, suddenly, as you say, there were like 1,000 revellers coming in the other direction.
Well, why didn't you stay? You were meant to stay the night. At the point, we opened 30 exhibitions simultaneously.
Yeah.
You have won.
Yeah, yeah.
You were showing these wonderful Vivian Westwood photographs you had that you'd taken from Sex.
That's right.
Prior to the Sex Pistols becoming famous.
That's right.
And because you locked out. Sorry, I'm just saying that.
No, nope.
I'm teasing you, right? I really have. I know that it wasn't just a drop there. And we didn't have specific openings at that time, so it was the party, and it was beginning at Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the idea was meant to be that you stayed and revelled with the rest of them.
Yeah, but I don't want to revel. I'm not a reveller.
Why not?
It's just not in my nature to revel. Do you revel, Megan?
No. I
hear you slept with... with Frederick Hakkabeva's wife one time, didn't you? That's reveling.
I don't know who Frederick Hakkabeva's wife is. This is your story. What do you call that?
That was the joke.
Is that channeling or something?
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
Actually, Frederick's a wonderful man. He looks like a very large bat because he wears those black large cloaks behind him and walks around very fast and is a very imposing figure.
Yeah.
But he's intellectually an amazing guy.
Okay.
He has kept letterism alive.
Yeah.
He reissues
Maurice Lemaitre LPs and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Izu was a difficult person to be friendly with.
Yeah.
And he was there when Izu died.
Right.
And for the last year, Izu couldn't talk. And for somebody whose entire life was to be a communicator and, a person who made vocal music, I mean, that must have been very hard.
Yeah, yeah.
So Frederick was there at the end. Maurice Lemaitre is still there. Apparently an awful person to know. I mean, difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
And Frederick always said to me that the French establishment would never accept letterism until Izu died because he defended so many people because he wrote polemic and would just condemn people out of hand.
Yeah.
And I think it's starting to be seen that's true. You know, he's gone. Lemaitre's pretty old now.
Yeah.
So wait for the Pompidou Centre retrospective.
You know.
But that's also got Henri Chopin on it, who was a French artist who came over here and had the record Où, review Où, and is it Cinquième Saison that he had as well?
Yeah.
And that's the most bizarre thing, that all these Chopin works that you couldn't sell for 100 quid, they're going for thousands.
Yes. There's the Saltoun Gallery.
Saltoun seems
to specialise in concrete poetry at the moment. And they had a group show of concrete poets. And they didn't have a price list. And I went into the gallery and they'd got Chopin, Bob Cobbing, Sylvester Huidard, and like three others. And I sort of casually said to the person at the back, how much are they? How much do these go for? And they said, oh, between 500 and 50,000. So I said, oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Which one is 50,000? And they said, oh, the Henri Chopin. So it seems to
what
be...
What was it?
They're all just typewriter poems, you know. It's just like a sort of...
In all honesty, if you walk into a gallery and you pay the price they ask, then you're an idiot.
Right.
I mean, you know, if you're not getting a percentage off that, at least... I mean, most galleries are taking 50% of an artist's money these days.
Right.
When they show a living artist.
Yeah. What do you take?
30 was, I don't take anything at the moment. I don't try to sell the works, but I used to take 30 when I was doing it the more.
Okay.
And I've never been beyond 30.
Right.
And at the moment, well, yeah, I would sell some of the works I'm showing, but I'd negotiate with the artist, you know.
Okay.
I mean, we've got Boltanski at the moment, but I'm showing an artist based in Rotterdam called Bobby Sayers, who did a performance on the night. We had the neighbours around. Some of those neighbours are somewhat elderly and probably hadn't seen an aching man for many years. But Bobby supplied that need. And then we have Amy Lee Bird, who's a very young artist, but she does archaeology. Basically, the works are, she finds a river or an area close by, and then she looks at parts from them, and she places them into deep, long vitrines in the water from the river, and they're just left there to deteriorate. Although the piece she did for me recently for Temple that I commissioned is actually an amazing tree root. I don't know how the hell she found it. It's the most ornate piece of tree root you've ever seen. It's deep in water, and of course, over time, the water will discolour and it will rot. So there's this element of, you know.
So this is showing at the moment in your place?
We're showing that in the car park, a couple of those, another piece called Binary, which is a mixture of soil from one part of Scotland and a ram's skull and water from locally to me.
Right.
And that's her first ever show.
Okay.
And I just met her at an art college opening and thought her work was good.
Yeah.
So, but I always do things really quickly. I mean, you know, I offered her a show and we had it up within 6 weeks.
Right,
right. Why plan? It's boring planning.
So you're thinking you're around for a few more days, you're going to the Frieze, you're going to go back to Frieze, or have you done it now?
I don't think we'll go back to Frieze. We might go back for a performance later on today. Tonight is two things. There's the Thomas Ruff opening.
Okay.
And then Jarvis Cocker is doing a disco in which his Megan's Chance to Shine, right? In which he's going to inspire mindfulness, I believe.
Oh, yeah?
Apparently so.
So why? How does Megan fit into this?
No, she's my memory for things like this.
He was.
Oh, I see. I thought you meant she was going to join in with the mindfulness.
No. Not at all.
What's it called? What do you remember of it?
It was just Jarvis Cocker.
Okay.
That was it.
But what's he doing? Is he performing or just sort of, is he master of ceremonies or something?
It's at 180 Strand, which at the moment has a giant show by Listen called Everything at Once.
Okay. Which is great. Go and see it.
But they also have the Vinyl Factory in the same building.
Oh, right.
And it's Jarvis Cocker, and I do believe it's in Pitch Black. And he's trying to recreate the sort of deep meditative state. Like mindfulness using a DJ he runs a night in Glasgow called Optimal.
Okay.
Not sure.
Does he? Oh, right.
Not Jarvis Cocker, this other DJ.
Oh, I see. The DJ is working with the Vinyl Factory, perhaps. Yeah. Is that right? Yeah.
Something like that.
Right.
But that just, it sounds different.
Are you, do you have artistic aspirations?
No.
Not at all?
No.
No. Okay.
She's very modest. She makes pots.
Okay, all right. A ceramicist.
A ceramicist, yes. That's the big word for it.
Right. I'm just learning. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to Paul Robertson and Megan Bain.
Well, thank you for listening to the witterings of an old man.
For coming in. You're not that old, are you?
Yeah, 59 last week.
All right.
Well, though.
We didn't ask you. No one's asking your age. It's
I
all
don't
right.
mind.
It's all
right.
You don't. You don't look that old.
Well, thank you.
Thank you both for coming in anyway.
Thanks.
And we'll play out with the Frederick Aquaviva. It's actually by Dennis Dufour, I think, one of his artists.
What's it called? The Love of My Life, My Wife.
Can you see it?
No, it's crew too.
ぬるい無に包まれながら僕らは寒くもあり寒くもあり暑くもあった暑くもあった僕らは寒くもあり暑くもあった
そして断片に取りつかれ。
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.